I've been watching commercials lately. American car companies are suddenly selling miles per gallon. The Escalade, the Cadillac Escalade, last night had an ad on the Olympics. They're coming out with a hybrid. On the one hand, it looks odd, actually, like someone has produced a spoof or someone produced some mock examples of how things ought to be sometime in the future. And then on the other hand, it's what they could have been doing since the first oil shock of 1973. The energy companies would probably be no worse off. We will always need energy, and they'll be in the energy business. And the growing economies of the world, including China and India, will probably use up most of the oil, no matter how fast new technologies come online. In Olympics commercials, both GE and Exxon are selling themselves as being in the business of saving the environment. GE, one of the biggest players in nuclear weapons, nuclear power plants, and wind turbines. Exxon, who despite setting records each quarter for the most profit any U.S. company has ever earned, got the Supreme Court recently to reduce the punitive damages they owe the Alaskan fishermen whose lives were ruined by the Valdez oil spill 19 years ago. The Olympic ironies don't end there. George Bush keeps popping up on screen, giving Misty May Traynor a booty slap, or competing in the photo ops heavyweight division, desperately glomming some of the glow of our athletes and their achievements. You know, see, America still can do something. But it's not all PR for the failure-in-chief. He's also talking up human rights and civil liberties to the Chinese, after criminally subverting both at home. But despite the disingenuous ads of the game's corporate sponsors, the oil crisis is real. The climate crisis is real. The public health costs of pollution are real. The American way of delivering the American way of life is unsustainable. Gas costs over $4 a gallon, and the globalized system of trade on which we depend especially for food may no longer make even economic sense. My guest today, Hunter Lovins, has been thinking, writing, and consulting about these issues for over 30 years. Hunter Lovins has been, as I said, writing, thinking, and consulting about these issues for almost 30 years. Her work with the Rocky Mountain Institute, where she was involved and ran the place for about 20 years, and she's co-author of the book Natural Capitalism, and the 2006 Climate Protection Manual for Cities. Welcome, Hunter Lovins.
Thanks, Terry. It's great to be with you again.
Okay. As I was saying, we've got these things that are suddenly happening that could have been happening for a long time. But before we get into that, I always like people to get a feel for the people that we're talking to, not just the ideas and the work. So let me ask you briefly, you studied sociology and law. How did you get involved in the environment, and what was your involvement with L.A.'s own tree people in its early days?
I grew up out of doors. My father didn't have a whole lot of money. He was a college professor, so we spent vacations camping. I planted a tree for the first Earth Day in 1970 when I was still in college, and that oak tree in Southern California is still there. I went and visited it recently. My passion, if you will, was in trying to find solutions to the problems that were facing us. I worked early on with Dave Brower when he was still at Sierra Club, and then when Sierra Club fired him, he created Friends of the Earth. I transferred over as a member of Friends of the Earth and went to law school to try to practice environmental law, believing that law was a good way to solve the problems facing us. Rapidly decided that although I loved law school, I loved the study of law, the practice of law was not for me. It was not implementing the sorts of solutions that we wanted, and the big companies were just hiring most of the environmental lawyers. I deeply appreciate folk like Ralph Gavanna of Natural Resources Defense Council and the other great environmental lawyers and all that they've done to save so much for us, but it didn't seem to me that that was the approach that I wanted to take. So after my first year in law school, I started volunteering with a little group that had just been created by a man named Andy Lipkus in Southern California called California Conservation Project, which later came to be called Tree People because nobody could pronounce the full title, and what we did was plant smog-tolerant trees and do environmental education, people said, oh, here come the tree people. So we gave in to the inevitable and became the tree people. I was Andy's assistant director for 6 years in the early to mid-70s, still trying to figure out what were the real solutions to the problems. Planting trees is a wonderful thing to do, but it's not going to stop smog. Smog was an artifact of the misuse, the misunderstanding, the misallocation of energy. So driving the LA freeways, I'd be puzzling over, well, how do we meet the needs that we have in ways that don't create the problems that we're seeing, like smog? This is 1972. Energy policy is not a polite subject. A year later, it's on everybody's lips with the first Arab oil embargo. I'm still trying to figure out an internally consistent energy policy. Everybody has the answer. Oh, you build nuclear plants. Oh, you build windmills. Oh, you drill off the coast. And none of that seemed to be a coherent answer. It wasn't until 1976 when I read an article in Foreign Affairs magazine by a guy named Amory Lovins that I found the first internally consistent energy policy. But it was written for physicists and in highly technical language. I tried to convince the other tree people that this was what I'd been looking for. They sort of rolled their eyes and said, gee, that's nice. And I realized it needed translation, because what Amory said was very simple. What is it you're trying to do? What's the job? And then what's the amount and type and source of energy that will deliver that, that will do that job in the cheapest way? When you look at it that way, the cheapest way to meet our desires for the services that energy gives us, cold beer, hot showers, industrial shaft power, the ability to move around as we wish, is efficiency. It's the cheapest, easiest, and can deliver half or more of the services we want cheaper than what we're now paying to go out and get more energy. And almost nobody talks about
this point, the shift that you said, in other words, the shift from which is it oil, is it nuke, is it coal, to what is it you actually need energy for, and what's the most efficient, most sustainable way to power whatever it is you need. That's a big shift, and as you say, when you first saw it, it was a light bulb, and at that point, not even a compact fluorescent that went off in your head. So
Amory then pointed out that once you've implemented all of the cost-effective efficiency, the next most cost-effective option are the then available renewables. Now, this came as a revolution to the energy industry, which has always done its accounting somewhat, shall we say, mendaciously. They will take an existing coal plant and say, oh, well, that's delivering energy to us at 2 cents a kilowatt hour. If you build a solar panel on your roof, that's going to cost you 20 cents a kilowatt hour. That's obviously much more expensive. Well, you can't go build that old coal plant again. If you go out and try to build a new coal plant today, it's going probably to cost you at least 10 cents a kilowatt hour. And meantime, the solar panels are getting ever cheaper. So Southern California Edison is now building a 250-megawatt power plant on roofs spread around the county, using solar panels at a cost of about $850 million. A couple coal plants that were recently canceled up in the Montana area, a 250-megawatt operation, would have cost $800 million. So $850 million for energy that is free ever after versus $800 million for a facility where you'll have to continue to buy coal ever after, you do the math. We're very close to what's called grid parity, where the available renewables are cheaper than the historic polluting fossil fuels. And we've had, over 79 coal plants canceled, in many cases because the regulators said they are no longer the cheap option. Wind is.
Right. Let me just point out to people that the key thing there is, if you compare something that's already been built with something that needs to be built, you're leaving out the cost of the building. So what you're saying is, if we look to tomorrow, and I mean literally tomorrow, anything you're going to originate tomorrow, you put them, wind, solar, coal, nuclear, on an even playing field starting tomorrow, and that's where the reality really is.
That's correct. We can't build those old, cheap power plants again. We have to build plants that we can build today, and particularly with China and India demanding as many resources as they can lay hands on, steel, coal, oil, concrete, the ability to build a large centralized plant cheaply has evaporated. Almost any large plant you build today is going to cost you a lot of money. So, for example, I was down in Tampa, Florida, earlier this year. Headlines in the morning paper, the two nuclear units they're trying to build had been promised to come on at $4 billion apiece. Well, originally $1 billion apiece. They are now at $17 billion, and they're not even completed. To build a new nuclear plant, probably around $12 billion apiece. This is vastly more expensive than fixing up your home so it doesn't need as much electricity, so we don't need to build the plants in the first place. And now it's more expensive than putting solar panels on your roof. And yet we continue to have presidential candidates saying that, oh, well, the answer is nuclear. That's the thinking of the last century.
Right, exactly. Let me, I think I suggested to you earlier that if possible, I'd love to spend the next 14 minutes, basically, 13 minutes, going through just three questions, but they're big ones. One is, what is the evidence that our energy policy is broken? And then, what are the causes of why our energy policy is broken? And finally, what are the solutions to this, to fix this broken energy policy? And I use policy loosely to mean basically the way that we get, buy, produce, exchange energy.
Sure.
So
I think it's fairly obvious.
The evidence.
It's fairly obvious that our energy policy is broken. We use a bit over a third of our energy to move ourselves around in vehicles. So we now pay about $1 billion a day, most of that borrowed from the Chinese, to buy imported oil. The electricity that we use for iPods and light bulbs comes in general over 50% in this country from coal. The burning of coal is changing the climate, and indeed the scientists say that if we don't deal with climate change within the next 5 or so years, we will be foreclosing the capacity of the Earth to sustain life as we've known it. The poles are melting much faster than even the scientists had predicted. We're now getting the spread of disease into areas where it never was before because we're not getting the cold winters that used to kill off the bugs or make it impossible for them to live there. We're getting tidal surges into places like New Orleans in hurricanes and Myanmar. Thousands of people die periodically in Bangladesh. The drought in Africa, the Darfur problem, is caused by climate change. It's not a future problem. It's on us right now. Nick Stern, the UK economist, pointed out that if we don't deal with climate change, we will pay 20% of world gross domestic product every year dealing with the consequences. But fixing the problem would cost, he reckoned, about a percent or two of world GDP. And I actually think he got that wrong, because investing in what will fix climate change, i.e. energy efficiency and renewable energy, is also the best way to create American jobs, to revitalize our economy, and to drive prosperity here at home. Take one example. Dell Computer just announced that it is 96% of the way to meeting its 2008 goal of being climate neutral. By doing that, it saved $3 billion.
Excellent, excellent.
These, you know, company by company by company, Goldman Sachs about a year ago came out with a report showing that the companies that are the leaders in environment, social, and good governance policy have 25% higher stock value than their competitors. Last February, the Economist Intelligence Unit came out with a report showing that the worst performing companies were most likely to have nobody in charge of sustainability. There is now a robust business case for implementing the kind of sensible energy policy that we should have done years ago. Back in the 1950s, a group called the Paley Commission urged a transition away from fossil fuel to renewable energy and energy efficiency as a matter of grave national security. This report was recently repeated by the CIA and the National Security Council, said the same thing. We are vulnerable because of our dependence on imported oil and because of our dependence on very dangerous forms of energy. Our proposals to put LNG plants off the California coast.
Right.
Talk about a terrorist target. Come on.
And basically that one is natural gas is promoted, I think, as the much cleaner alternative to the other fossil fuels. So how did we get here? What are the causes of this, of what seems on the face of it, when you tell, for instance, that Dell, by cutting its climate impact and its pollution impact, saves a great deal of money, since that's the case, why are we so behind in this? As I say, as I said about those commercials at the top, we could have been doing that since 73 or before.
Americans seem to believe that we have a birthright to cheap energy and that the answer to our problems now is to drill more off the California coast, pump more oil, spew more pollution, and have cheap oil to fuel our petropigs. That's not the answer. The answer is to use technology to deliver the services we want, like mobility, in smarter ways. So, for example, in Curitiba, Brazil, they redesigned the transit system so that people can get where they want to get to quicker on buses than they can in cars. And these are high-tech buses that act like a metro. Curitiba has the highest car ownership and the lowest car usership. Communities like where I live in Boulder are designing new villages to be walkable and bikeable. If you still want to drive a car, let's have a car that gets at least 100 miles to the gallon. These cars can be made right here in the United States. And if we weren't subsidizing our oil companies and car companies to use last century's technologies, we'd have these better performing devices right now. Let's start demanding them. The reason we don't have a sensible energy policy is that we haven't stood up and said, we want it. We want a nation that's based on secure energy, affordable energy, independent energy that comes from renewable sources and that's efficiently used. That's the reason. It's our fault.
It's our fault, and basically it seems, again, like one of those things where people, if you ask people, do we want that? It seems to me the vast majority would say, oh, sure. But it doesn't rise to the top of their priority list to the point where they can provide a strong counterbalance to those industries who are entrenched, making billions and spending billions to promote the old, inefficient, dirty ways of doing things.
Sure, if you watch the Democratic convention, you'll see ads for clean coal. No, coal's not clean, neither is it safe. You will see ads for inexpensive, affordable nuclear power. No, it's not inexpensive, it's not affordable, and it's not clean either. The American people need to stand up and demand the kind of future that we want to have, and yet recent polls have shown that now an overwhelming number of Americans want more drilling, want lower gasoline prices. Time to stand up and say, that's not the answer. The answer is affordable energy services, the ability to get what we want, comfort in our building,
right,
industry, access, but to do it in smarter ways.
What are some of the, I mean, just very briefly before we move to solutions for the rest of the show, what are some of the subsidies, some of the things that the public doesn't realize they're paying for oil, coal, and nuclear?
Depends on whose numbers you believe. The American taxpayer is every year subsidizing the oil, gas, coal, and nuclear industry somewhere between $30 and $80 billion directly, and indirectly it's probably over $200 billion a year, making it look cheaper to mine coal, to pump and refine oil, to build highways for cars as opposed to rapid transit that works for everybody. These are choices that we're making in policy because we're not demanding smarter technologies.
And if I were a listener and I said that to someone and they said, well, what do you mean subsidizing them $30-80 billion? What are those subsidies?
They can be research dollars to what's called clean coal. Listen to the political candidates. McCain is calling for $500 billion in tax subsidies for nuclear power, $200 billion in subsidies for what's called clean coal. This is a way of burning coal that doesn't even exist yet. At the same time, we have most of the venture capital money going into clean technology, into solar, into wind, into what are called lipid algaes to make biofuels that don't compete with food crops, in ways to make super efficient cars. These clean technologies are winning in the marketplace despite enormous subsidies going to the dirty technology.
Right. What I can hear there is that if you're a corporation with a dirty or an inefficient technology, or as I say, a 20th century technology, you invest in politicians and parties rather than a venture capitalist actually invests in something which has a future. Okay. Third question. What are the solutions?
The solutions are emerging very rapidly all around us. First of all, use energy much more efficiently. It's cost-effective now to save at least half the energy we use. Amory says 90%, but let's start with half. How do you do it? Change out every light bulb in your house to a compact fluorescent or to an LED. Change out your refrigerator. If it's sitting there running, go buy an Energy Star refrigerator. Your utility will probably help you do that, and it will save you money as it sits there and provides colder food at a much lower price. Every energy-using device in your house, unless you have already changed it out, is out of date. Go get a super efficient one. And if you still believe that spending is the way out of our economic crisis, that's what you'll be doing. By spending on the clean technologies and the smart technologies, you'll be helping to grow our economy. Then look at your house itself. Does it need air conditioning to keep you comfortable in the summer? Does it need artificial heat to keep you comfortable in the winter? Then you're living in an inefficient house. Even an old house can be fixed up so that it needs no energy to keep you comfortable year-round. Then your car. Are you driving a Petra Pig? We ought to have a system called a feebate. When you go to register a car, you pay a fee or get a rebate, depending on how efficient the car is. If I want to drive a big old inefficient truck to haul my horses, I pay a fee, and when you register your Prius or Volt, you get a rebate that comes out of my fee. Same thing when you go to build a house. You ought to pay a fee or get a rebate, depending on how efficient it is. State-of-the-art now in buildings is buildings that need no energy to keep them comfortable year-round. State-of-the-art in cars is at least 80 miles a gallon, and there are some test cars getting well over 100. Round at every way in which you in your life use energy and demand that it be a much more efficient one. You can start putting renewables onto your house. A solar shower feels better, and it sure costs a whole lot less.
Okay, we got to wrap it up, but you've set people, I think, in the right direction. It's like, look at every place you use energy. There's probably a cleaner, better way, and if you both go out and buy it, and then go out and pressure your politicians to deliver it. Thank you to G, my engineer, to Stan Mizrahim Production, Matt Perez in Traffic, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. The website to learn more about Hunter Lovin's work is natcapsolutions.org, natcapsolutions.org. And the best book I think she's been involved with so far is Natural Capitalism. Email me at temcnally@mac.com if you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, or learn how to get my onto my podcast.